Welcome one and all to this, the start of the 2010 University of St Andrews Gifford Lectures, and a special welcome to our lecturer, Roger Scruton. We've not had a series of Gifford Lectures here since 2002, and I'm delighted that in resuming the sequence begun 120 years ago, in 1889, by Andrew Lang, we've secured the services of so gifted a thinker, writer and lecturer. Before I say more about Roger Scruton, however, I should like to speak for a minute or two about the Giffords, their benefactor and their history. In 1847, the Scots lawyer Adam Gifford attended a series of talks in Edinburgh given by the American poet and philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson's presence there marked something of the developing desire of Americans to give back in kind to the Scots from whom they'd acquired a taste for philosophical and religious ideas. In 1901, introducing his own subsequently famous series of Giffords, The Varieties of Religious Experience, William James remarked that it seems the natural thing for us to listen while Europeans talk. The contrary habit of talking while Europeans listen we have not yet acquired. And in him who first makes the adventure, it begets a certain sense of apology being due for so presumptuous an act. Particularly must this be the case on a soil as sacred to the American imagination as that of Scotland. But as we've just seen, James was not the first to make that adventure. And I suspect that Emerson's talks may have been an inspiration for Gifford's later decision to endow a lecture series in philosophy and religion. Certainly their substance influenced Gifford's own thinking in the direction of metaphysics and transcendentalism. By stages, Gifford's legal career progressed and he acquired the title Lord, not as a peer, but as a member of the Court of Session. His private practice as an advocate enabled him to accumulate enormous wealth, which he was then generous in disposing of, and we today are beneficiaries of that generosity. In his will of 1885, Gifford wrote of his deep and firm conviction that the true knowledge of what he termed, in the abstractions of the time, God, that is, the being, nature, and attributes of the infinite, of the all, of the first and the only cause, and of the relations of man and of the universe to him, and of the true foundations of all ethics and morals, this knowledge, when really felt and acted on, is the means of man's highest well-being and the security of his upward progress. With that ideal and end in mind, Gifford resolved to institute within the then existing Scottish universities, St Andrews, Glasgow, Aberdeen and Edinburgh, a lectureship for the promotion of the study of these subjects, and, as he added, for the teaching and diffusion of sound views regarding them among the whole population of Scotland. Gifford prescribed in his will that the lecturers shall be under no restraint whatsoever in their treatment of their theme. For example, they may freely discuss all questions about man's conception of God, of the infinite, of their origin, nature and truth, whether he can have any such conceptions, I think I nod to Kant at that point, whether God is under any or what limitations, and so on, as I am persuaded that nothing but good can result from the discussion. He continued, the lectures shall be public and popular, that is open not only to students of the universities, but to the whole community, as I think that the subject should be studied and known by all, whether receiving university instruction or not. I think such knowledge, if real, lies at the root of all well-being. Well, the nobility of Gifford's conception and the sincerity of the intent, of his intent, are evident from these brief extracts from his will, and they communicated themselves to the four series of public lectures in the four Scottish universities on the broad theme of natural theology, the theme that carries his name and which continue to be provided for out of his original benefaction. And the wine that you will be drinking, those of you who choose to drink that wine following the lecture across in Lower College Hall, which we're all welcome, will be provided for out of Gifford's benefaction. Over the years, the name of these lectures has acquired a standing in the academy and in the world of scholarly letters akin to that of Nobel. And the lecturers have included the most eminent philosophers, theologians, and scholars of human culture of their times, many of whom have an enduring legacy still being read and written about today. The first Giffords began in 1889 with three series of lectures by, respectively, the Hegelian philosopher James Stirling, the philologist Friedrich Muller, and here in St Andrews, the Scots-born literary figure Andrew Lang. Lang was well known in his own day for the breadth of his interests and the range of his talents. His literary output was considerable as a journalist, a poet, a critic, a historian, a translator, an editor, an author. And we continue to honour him, in fact, through another public lecture in the university that bears his name. Well, fittingly for this resumption of the St Andrews Gifford series, our present lecturer is similar to Andrew Lang, both in the range of his gifts and in his industrious use of them. Roger Scruton is one of Britain's best known and most distinguished philosophers and public intellectuals. He's a graduate of the University of Cambridge, where he was also a research fellow at Peterhouse, and is a barrister of the Inns of Court. He's held professorships at the universities of London and Boston, and visiting positions at Princeton and currently at Oxford University. He's a fellow of the British Academy and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. He's also well known to the public as a columnist and broadcaster, discussing matters of the moment and, as a wine writer, no less, matters of the palate. Scruton's very many publications include Art and Imagination, The Aesthetics of Architecture, widely regarded, by the way, as the most important work on that subject, perhaps of the 20th century, but certainly since Gilbert Scott's The Architecture of Humanism, The Politics of Culture, The Aesthetic Understanding, Kant, Sexual Desire, Spinoza, The Philosopher on Dover Beach, Modern Philosophy, Animal Rights and Wrongs, The Aesthetics of Music, Death Devoted Heart on Wagner, Culture Counts, Beauty, also the subject of a recent BBC Two film, Understanding Music, and a volume of autobiography, at least one volume of autobiography, Gentle Regrets. Among philosophers writing today, I can think of no one better placed to pursue Lord Gifford's noble intent, and we're very grateful that he's accepted the invitation to do so, speaking under the general title of The Face of God. Please welcome Roger Scruton and his first lecture, The View from Nowhere.
Thank you very much for that warm introduction, and I hope I can meet the spirit of these lectures with the kind of thoughts that I'm going to give you over the next 3 weeks. Obviously, I'm not a theologian and come very much from the area of philosophy where it impinges upon cultural and artistic interests generally. So I've tried to reach into my own experience and things that I've felt without necessarily being able to articulate them, and have tried to articulate them for the purpose of these lectures and to bring them into relation with the concept of God as I understand it and with my own sense of God's presence in my life. So this is the first one today is a fairly abstract, but I'm going to become more concrete as I go along. Lord Gifford's bequest was to sponsor lectures that would promote and diffuse the knowledge of God. Gifford, as you've already heard, was not an orthodox adherent of any religion, but someone who nevertheless believed that man's relation to God is the most important relation he has. He lived among people who shared that belief, and he himself assumed that philosophy, psychology, and anthropology would confirm it. I doubt that he anticipated the culture that prevails today, in which the belief in God is widely rejected as incompatible with modern science, or at least widely rejected in this country. But I think he would have endorsed the attempt to explore what we lose when we lose that belief. And this will be one of my themes in these lectures. I will be considering some of the consequences of the atheist culture that is growing around us, and I will suggest that it is not only an intellectual phenomenon expressing a disbelief in God, but also a moral phenomenon. And in its moral aspect, the atheist culture involves a turning away from God. You might wonder how someone can deliberately turn away from a thing that he believes not to exist. But it is a peculiarity of God that we can do just this to him. And we do this, I maintain, by acts of systematic aggression towards the face. Not the human face only, but the face of the world. I don't deny that atheists can be thoroughly upright people, far better people than I am. But there is more than one motive underlying the atheist culture of our times, and the desire to escape from the eye of judgment is one of them. You escape from the eye of judgment by blotting out the face. I want to speak today, however, about the scientific worldview, which many people believe is the real source of our current doubts about the belief in God. According to Richard Dawkins, who is, of course, the most prominent of the evangelical atheists writing today, human beings are, as he puts it, survival machines in the service of their genes. We are, so to speak, byproducts of a process that is entirely indifferent to our well-being, machines developed by our genetic material by way of furthering its reproductive goal. Of course, goal is not quite the right word in such a context. Genes themselves are complex molecules put together in accordance with the laws of chemistry from material made available in the primal soup that once boiled on the surface of our planet. How it happened is not yet known. Maybe electrical discharges cause nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen atoms to link together in appropriate chains until finally one of them achieved that remarkable feature of encoding the instructions for its own reproduction. Science may one day be able to solve the question how this occurred, but it is science, not religion, that will solve the question. As for the existence of a planet in which the elements abound in the quantities that they abound on planet Earth, such a thing is again to be explained by science, though the science of astrophysics rather than the science of biology. The existence of the Earth is part of a great unfolding process, which may or may not have begun with a big bang, and which contains many mysteries that physicists explore with ever-increasing astonishment. Astrophysics has raised as many questions as it has answered, but they are scientific questions, to be solved by discovering the laws of motion that govern the observable changes at every level of the physical world, from galaxy to quark and from black hole to supernova. The mystery that confronts us as we gaze upwards at the Milky Way, knowing that the stars crystallized in that smear of light are merely stars of a single galaxy, the galaxy that contains us, and that beyond its boundaries a myriad other galaxies slowly turn in space, some dying, some emerging, all forever inaccessible to us. This mystery does not call for a religious response, for it is a mystery that results from our partial knowledge, and which can be solved only by further knowledge of the same kind, the knowledge that we call science. Only ignorance would cause us to deny that general picture, and many atheists today assume that monotheistic religion must deny that picture and must, therefore, at some level, commit itself to the propagation of ignorance, or at any rate, the suppression of knowledge. As for the atheists themselves, they deduce from the scientific worldview, as I shall call it, two far-reaching metaphysical doctrines. First, that everything in the natural world, human thought and action included. Hang on, I've forgotten entirely about my. There you are. I've got up to point four there. First, then, that everything in the natural world, human thought and action included, happens in accordance with scientific laws, so that the same laws govern events in the atom and events in the galaxy. Even events in the ocean and events in the mind. Secondly, that everything that happens is contingent. There is no reason for its happening other than the fact that it happens in the sequence dictated by the laws of nature. There is no final explanation of why the world exists. It just does. Indeed, there is something incoherent about the question why asked of the existence of the world. We can, by observation and experiment, arrive at explanations of one event in terms of others, and we can link event to event in a continuous causal chain. But the idea that we can step outside the chain of events and ask for an explanation of it is like the idea that we can see beyond the edge of our visual field and so set a limit to it. The argument was developed by Kant in The Antinomies of Pure Reason, which is a section or a chapter of the Critique of Pure Reason. And it has haunted philosophy ever since. Not only philosophy, it's haunted science ever since. It was the main inspiration for Einstein's theory of relativity. At some point, we are compelled to accept that this is how things are, and that explanations are at an end. Any attempt to see the world as a whole, so as to find an explanation of it, is doomed to failure. Indeed, Kant thought, it will end in contradiction. Such an attempt could succeed only if we could think outside the limits of our own thinking and attain to the transcendental perspective that is God's. From that perspective, it is conceivable that a proof of God's existence could be given, but necessarily it is a perspective that could never be ours. That Kantian argument has the interesting corollary that only God could ever prove God's existence. And one assumes he doesn't need to. We can summarize the atheist picture, therefore, in two doctrines: that everything happens in accordance with the laws of nature, and that those laws are contingent, summarizing the way things are, and being without any further explanation. We know that the universe is without a plan and without a goal, not because we have looked for those things and failed to find them, but because nothing discoverable to science could count as a plan or a goal for the universe in its entirety. Now, it is not easy to be satisfied with a worldview that maintains those two positions. Surely, we feel, the law-governed nature of the universe requires an explanation. We may not phrase the question in religious terms, but there is nevertheless a question why. Why is the universe governed by comprehensive laws? If all is contingent, then why is it not random? One response is to look for some proof of divine intervention in the sheer unlikelihood of a law-governed universe. And people have been generating arguments recently to the effect that the primitive constants that physics relies upon to generate its laws of nature need to be altered only in the tiniest fraction for the universe to be such a place such in which consciousness could not have emerged. And then people have drawn the conclusion, therefore it's so improbable that the universe should be as it is, that some extra universal force must be at work in making it as it is. That, I think, is an extremely poor argument. Statements of probability cannot be made about the universe as a whole. They rely upon long-range frequencies observed within our world and not to be applied outside it. Another response to this question is contained in Stephen Hawking's weak anthropic principle, which holds that if the universe were random, it would also be unknowable, since it is only in a law-governed universe, and one very like this one, that creatures capable of knowledge could exist. Knowledge is, after all, a highly delicate condition, in which states of affairs are causally connected to their own representation. Such a condition presupposes far-reaching law-like connections. Hence, if we can look for explanations at all, the universe cannot be random, but must be governed by finely tuned causal laws. It doesn't so happen that the universe is law-governed. If it were not so, we could not know that it were not so. Well, that suggestion recalls the transcendental idealism of Kant. The world, Kant argued, must conform to the a priori requirements of the understanding. It must be ordered in space and time, and it must conform to the categories, to those concepts like substance and cause, without which we could not make judgments. Those concepts can be meaningfully used only if certain principles are true of the world to which they are applied. Hence we can know a priori that the world does conform to those principles, since they are the preconditions of knowledge. One of these principles is the law of causality, the law that every event has a cause. The truth of this law is a matter of synthetic a priori knowledge, and therefore not merely contingent. Now, I think it's fair to say that Kant did not succeed in carrying that argument to the conclusion that he wanted. The best that he could prove is that the world must appear ordered if we are to make judgments about it. But this is not so much a fact about the world as a fact about us and our epistemological capacities. The question I am pursuing is rather different from the one that occupied Kant, namely, why, to what end, and for what reason do we live in a law-governed world? It may be that any other world would not be a world that contains creatures like us who can ask that kind of question. But then, why, to what end, and for what reason is there a world that contains creatures like us? If we inquire into the matter, we soon discover that the laws of nature are very queer things. No theory is better founded than quantum mechanics, which has been confirmed in all its predictions, including the very strange prediction that the condition of one particle might be linked to that of another, even though no force can pass between them. And quantum mechanics seems to imply that the limits to the observable are limits to the real. What is and what is knowable are, from the point of view of scientific explanation, one and the same. We can know only what we can measure, and our measurements change the situations to which they are applied. Now, this has the consequence, as Heisenberg showed, that the laws of nature are indeterminate. The ultimate truth about the physical world consists in a set of irreducible probabilities. Dawkins writes as though the theory of the selfish gene puts paid once and for all to the idea of a creator God. We no longer need that hypothesis in order to explain how he came to be. In a sense, that is true, and of course was already said by Laplace in the 18th century. But what about the gene itself? How did that come to be? What about the primordial soup? All these questions are answered, of course, by going one step further down the chain of causation. But at each step, we encounter a world with a singular quality, namely, that it is a world which, left to itself, will produce conscious beings, able to look for the reason and the meaning of things, and not just for the cause. The astonishing thing about our universe, that it contains consciousness, judgment, the knowledge of right and wrong, and all the other things that make our condition so singular, is not rendered less astonishing by the hypothesis that this state of affairs emerged over time from other conditions. If true, that merely shows us how astonishing those other conditions were. The gene and the soup cannot be less astonishing than their product. But is this astonishment just a blank astonishment, one that can never be solaced and subdued? I don't think so. Some help can be gained by turning to the question that causes all our problems, the question why. This is where I begin talking about the God of the philosophers, a very dry, abstract topic, I'm afraid, but it was the only time when these lectures will be totally dry. Aristotle argued the question I want to consider is the question why. Aristotle argued that this question can be answered in four different ways, and that each way of answering introduces a different kind of cause, of a cause. His theory of the four causes was swept aside by the scientific worldview, which recognizes only one kind of cause, what Aristotelians called the efficient cause, and one kind of law, which is the mathematically expressed connection of quantities connecting cause to effect. Nevertheless, Aristotle was right in one respect. It is in the nature of consciousness to ask another kind of why question from the one posed by the scientist. The why of science looks always for a quantitative law and a determining condition that is governed by it. consciousness, by which I mean the reflective stance to the world, which strives to see the world always from outside and as a whole, is not satisfied with the why of science. It is troubled by the why of reason, and also by the why of meaning. What reason is there for the world's existence? And what does this existence mean? Those are not meaningless questions, however hard they may be to answer. That is what the why of reason is looking for, not a purpose necessarily, but something that removes the paradox of an entirely law-governed world open to consciousness that is nevertheless without an explanation, that just is, for no reason at all. The theologians of the Middle Ages wrestled with this problem, drawing inspiration from the strange, stark theology contained in Aristotle's Metaphysics and also in the theological arguments of the Kalam philosophers of the Islamic world. Aristotle believed that motion requires an explanation and that therefore there must be an unmoved mover who makes the world go round. And he really did literally think that it goes round. This unmoved mover acts on the world not as an efficient cause, but as a final cause. In other words, not as the cause of motion, but as its goal, the thing towards which everything points. God moves the world as the beloved moves the lover, so Aristotle expressed the point. And this universal object of love has both life and thought. He is a transcendental spirit who exists eternally as both the subject and the object of an unending contemplation. Now, Aristotle's view raises in a vivid way the question that I wish to discuss in these lectures, which is the question of God's presence. How can such a being, as Aristotle describes, take an interest in, be revealed to, or be in any way related to us in this world? This question becomes even more vivid when we turn to the arguments of the medieval philosophers, and in particular that introduced by Avicenna, or Ibn Sina, as he's known, of course, in the Muslim world, the argument from contingent being. This argument is a metaphysical reconfiguration of Aristotle's argument for the prime mover. It was designed to show that the contingent being of anything at all is explicable only on the assumption that being is not always contingent. In other words, that there is a necessary being. The task of theology was thereafter conceived as that of explicating the concept of a necessary being. What else must be true of something if it is to exist necessarily and not contingently? To the delight of the monotheists of the Middle Ages, the attributes of the necessary being, as they unfolded them in thought, coincided with those attributed in the Torah, the Gospels, and the Quran to the one God. It's worth pausing to consider how Avicenna arrived at this conclusion. Being, Avicenna argued, is caught in three predicaments. There are impossible beings, those whose definition involves a contradiction. There are contingent beings, those which might not have existed, and there are necessary beings. The contingent being has the potentiality both to be and not to be, without contradiction. You and I are contingent beings in that sense. And even if I am granted a certain intuition of my own existence, that certainty is merely a personal possession, and neither guarantees my survival nor refutes the view that there are possible worlds in which I am not. A necessary being is one that is true in itself, in other words, whose existence follows from its nature, whereas a contingent being is false in itself, which is to say, it owes its truth to other things. In other words, it is contingent upon the thing that causes or sustains it. The necessary being has no essence other than existence itself. Hence, it cannot be distinguished from others of its supposed kind, all of which are identical with it. The necessary being, therefore, is one, a point later taken up by Spinoza and used to argue that nothing exists except the one necessary being. But this argument was connected by Avicenna with that central concept in all Islamic thinking, the concept of tawhid, which means recognizing in heart, mind and soul the essential and creative oneness of God. at the penultimate point there. Avicenna argued that since all contingent beings are contingent upon some other thing to which their existence is owed, there must be a necessary being on which they all depend. Avicenna argued for this in one way, Aquinas taking up the argument in another. And Aquinas' argument is fairly familiar. Suppose, he argues, that there is no necessary being, and that all beings might not have been. Since time, in which all contingencies occur, is infinite, there being, on the hypothesis, no being who can set limits to it, then it is true of any contingent being that there will be some time at which it is not. And therefore some time at which all contingent beings are not, a time of utter nothingness. But this null point of the universe must already have existed, since past time, like future time, is infinite. And since nothing can arise out of nothing, then there would, from that point, be forever nothing. But there is something, namely this thing, which is pondering the question of being. So the hypothesis must be false, which means that there is, after all, the necessary being on which all other things depend. And this thing is, to adapt Avicenna's language, causa sui, cause of itself. It is dependent on itself, the sustainer of everything. And it is one thing, a unity, admitting, in the words of the Quran, no partners. Not that Aquinas used the words of the Quran, but Avicenna did. One of the many insights that are contained in this argument, and all the subtle, if at times tedious, metaphysics that flow from it in the medieval schools, is the implication that the world of contingent beings to which we belong is governed by its own laws, the laws of generation and passing away. We discover those laws through scientific investigation, and they are the laws of nature that bind us all. They include those laws of genetics, which in the view of Dawkins provide a final refutation of the belief in God. But according to Avicenna, there is another relation of dependence than the one explored by science, the relation of the contingent to the necessary, of the world to its sustainer. And this is not a relation subject to empirical inquiry, nor one that can be known or refuted by scientific advance. The relation of dependence that binds the world to God gives the reason why things are as they are. But this reason is not a cause. Causes are the subject matter of science and are spelled out by the universal laws that we discover through experiment and observation. The causal relation is a relation in time, which binds temporal and therefore contingent entities. In referring to the ultimate reason of things, we are dealing here with another kind of answer to the question why. And another meaning of therefore. And this is what gives sense to the life of prayer, at least according to Avicenna. We do not suppose that God can be summoned to our aid at every instance, or that he is waiting in the wings of nature, dealing out the cards. If we take the ideas behind Avicenna's argument seriously, then we move towards another idea of God than that which informs the superstitious mind. God's freedom is revealed in the laws that bind us, and by which he too is bound, since it would be a loss of God's freedom, and not a gain, were he to defy the laws through which we understand him. But this does not mean, for the pious, a Muslim at least, that God is beyond our reach. He is in and around us, and our prayers shape our personal relation with him. We address him as we address those we love, not with the why of explanation, but with the why of reason. We want to know the end rather than the cause, and to school ourselves in the discipline of acceptance. It is this posture, rather than my belief in supernatural interventions, that forms the religious worldview, the posture of submission or Islam. I used to be very sceptical of those old arguments, largely for the reason spelled out by Kant, this is the penultimate point here, who pointed out that they all involve the attempt to go beyond the limits of scientific thinking and to apply concepts like cause, substance, and quality to the world conceived as a whole rather than to the empirically encountered items within it. There is, Kant suggested, always an illegitimate leap from the realm of understanding in which we apply our thinking to experience to the realm of pure reason in which we are tempted to ask questions that have no answer, since they apply concepts outside the domain in which they make real distinctions. Just such an unanswerable question is the one I have been considering, the question why, asked of the world as a whole. Kant, however, was very ambivalent towards his own conclusion. He took the view that the tendency of reason to overstep the bounds of science is both incorrigible and inevitable. The question why will not go away just because of a philosophical theory that condemns it as illegitimate. For it is a question that bears on the most fundamental of all our anxieties, the anxiety of existence itself. Why am I is a question that you may dismiss as having no answer, but by so dismissing it, you also answer it. And your answer does nothing to change the mind of people who feel the force of this question day after day in their personal lives. If you accept Avicenna's argument from contingent being, then you must also accept that the relation of dependence between God and the world is not a causal relation. That is to say, it is not a special case of those law-like connections between contingent events that we know through the methods of empirical science. The God of the philosophers, as he has been called, is not an empirical but a transcendental being, one whose nature and being place him outside the world of empirical particulars, sustaining that world in some way, but not in the way that a pillar holds up a beam or a mother supports her child. It then becomes hard to envisage how such a being, whose nature is eternally the same, could intervene in the world at all. We seem indeed to be forever and irremediably cut off from him. He becomes the hidden god, the Deus absconditus, as Aquinas described him. And how can we relate to such a god? How can we love him or know that he loves us in return? If we resolve the tension between the theistic and the scientific worldview in Avicenna's way, then, the danger is that we end up with an unknowable and unlovable god, since only what is knowable can be truly loved. This problem occurs not merely for the god of Avicenna, but also for the god of Averroes, of Moses Maimonides, even of Aquinas. For the problem arises precisely because we have proved God's existence from purely abstract premises and without reference to how things are in the empirical world. The argument with which we answer science ends by hiding God. But what use to us is this transcendental being about whom nothing can be known except that he lies beyond knowledge? How can we partake of the view from nowhere that is God's? How can we pray to such a God, and how can we make room for him in our lives as one makes room for a spouse or a friend? Surely God must be present in the world if we are to have faith in him, for faith is a personal relation, a relation of trust, that demands the kind of mutuality that one free being can offer to another in the world of space and time. Now, if the belief in God were nothing more than a piece of abstract metaphysics, it is hard to see that it would matter whether we believe or disbelieve. Science plus metaphysics is the equivalent of science when it comes to real and practical decisions. But there is another aspect to religious belief, one that has been of far greater interest to anthropologists and psychologists than the abstruse metaphysical reasoning of the philosophers. This aspect was famously sketched out for us, or developed for us, by Durkheim in his great essay, The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, published over a century ago. It's been evident since Durkheim that religions exist and endure in part because they offer membership. You are born into a faith or converted to it, and you may find it difficult to leave without an existential catastrophe. In some cases, such as Islam, you are forbidden to leave the faith. You may lapse into a state of ignorance or jahiliyyah, but conversion to another faith is a capital offence. So this raises a new question. How can belief be a form of membership? The simple answer is that belief is a form of membership when it defines a community. By signing up to the doctrine, you are incorporated into the community. And this incorporation is regularly reaffirmed through sacred rites that signify in some way the collective relation of the community to its God. Now, it is, of course, absurd to think in that way of scientific beliefs, which offer nothing by way of membership, and indeed nothing save themselves, along with the challenge to refute them. A challenge which, according to Popper's plausible view of things, is integral to their claim to be science. Indeed, when a system of beliefs begins to persecute those who do not accept it, we know, or ought to know, that it is only a pseudoscience. That surely is transparently obvious in the case of Freudianism and Marxism, two so-called sciences that turned the world upside down by laying claim to the souls rather than the free opinions of their followers. I think it is this fact about religion, far more than any apparent conflict between its doctrines and the theories of physics, which explains the sense that somehow religion and science are at odds with each other. If a belief offers membership, then it has to be protected in some way. The destiny of a human community has been bound up with it, and the defence of the belief is the defence of that community. This explains the concept of heresy and why heretics are so severely treated by traditional religions. It explains why heretics are more fiercely persecuted the smaller their deviation from orthodoxy. Deviate far enough and you are not part of the community, so that your beliefs can be ignored. Deviate by an inch and you threaten the community from within. And we've seen this, of course, in witch hunts down the centuries right into our present time, even witch hunts conducted by atheists who believe themselves to be conducting them in the name of science. Now, this is the aspect of religion which I think most troubles those religious people who have a respect for science and scientific method and who have absorbed the many lessons of the Enlightenment, wishing to follow the path of religion within the limits of reason alone, as Kant expressed it in the title of his book on this subject. How can we reconcile the community-forming nature of religious beliefs with their claims to truth? Are we, through faith, rescuing belief from refutation? And how can that be done without destroying its nature as a genuine belief, something that might be true or false, depending on the evidence? Once we see this is one of Kant's principal worries, of course, about religion, which he wanted to retain, but in a form that would be immune from this kind of objection. But once we see this, we shall inevitably be tempted by Nietzsche's project of giving a genealogy of religious belief. We ask the question, whence does this belief arise, if it is not the result of intellectual speculation? How and in response to what thoughts or experiences does it change? And the simple and straightforward answer seems to be the right one. Religious belief is received from a community, typically the community into which you are born, and changes in response to changes in that community. Of course, it is also embellished by doctrine and developed by rational inquiry, but the results of this inquiry become accepted into the religion only when the community has reshaped itself so as to protect them from doubt. Science might attempt to explain religious belief precisely by emphasizing this communal quality, therefore, as Durkheim tried. But now Durkheim's cultural theory of religion tends to be replaced by evolutionary psychology. Religion, the evolutionary psychologist might say, is an adaptation which promotes our ability to stand together, to claim and defend our territory, and to make the kinds of sacrifice that are needed for collective survival, and therefore for our own survival, as beneficiaries of the collective. The nature and scope of such evolutionary explanations is a matter to which I return in the next lecture, but we should not overemphasize them. Adaptations are themselves adapted, and in human beings the process of adaptation proceeds rapidly and in a way that has no precedent among the lower animals. We are rational animals who furnish our biological needs with a justifying commentary. Hence, for us, life with religion differs at every level from life without it. This is something that we should have learned from Durkheim, but it needs to be repeatedly reaffirmed, not least because the illusion persists among enlightened thinkers that religion consists merely in a set of beliefs long ago disproved by science, but clung to nevertheless for the comfort that they afford. The connection between belief in God and the community of believers is recognized in the Christian concept of communion. And this connection, far from casting doubt on the validity of transcendental theology, points the way to supplying what it lacks. The communion is, theologically, the real presence of God among us. And it is from such acts of participation that we come to see who God is and how he relates to us. It is through the communion that we come face to face with God. In other words, what is, from the scientific view, a defect in religious belief, namely that it has the authority of a community, is, from the theological point of view, a strength. For it is this connection with the community that enables us to bridge the gap opened by the arguments of the philosophers, and to find the transcendental God that is allegedly proved by those arguments as a real presence in our world. That thought is the one that I wish to explore in these lectures. I want to argue that we can reconcile the God of the philosophers with the God who is worshipped and prayed to by the ordinary believer, provided we see that this God is understood not through metaphysical speculations concerning the ground of being, but through communion with our fellow humans. The religious community adapts the view from nowhere that is God's to the view from somewhere that is ours. We can justify this, I maintain, by exploring more fully the meaning of three critical metaphysical words, I, you, and why. And in exploring those words, I shall be constructing a general theory of the face of the person, the face of the world, and finally, the face of God.
Professor Scruton is really just laying out something of the territory that he's going to cover in the next 3 weeks. But we have an opportunity even so for questions and observations of people who would like to raise those points, and I'll let you deal with those results.
Yes, as John just said, and this is the prelude to the argument. The argument hasn't been written yet, and it may change as I go along, but any questions would be welcome.
Professor Scruton, what you said then there sounded a bit like the global warming. Like global warming claims to be a science, and yet it really is the belief of a community, in the sense that the real power is that all scientists in the world agree.
Mm.
You think it's more of a religion than a science.
Well, it is a very important observation to make, of course, that when a belief becomes an orthodoxy around which a community forms, we are obviously in the same territory as we are when dealing with a religion. And people have said this about various environmental movements. And of course, you're thinking of all the controversy recently about that particular thing. I think one certainly would be inclined to say that if this was purely scientific, then we would be sitting down and simply talking about the facts. But it isn't purely scientific. There is a community involving element in it. And yes, it could develop to the point of becoming something like a religion. It needs more than just the community. It needs what I've was hinting at the end, which is a sense of the real presence of the supernatural, the real presence of the otherwise hidden God. And that you do get, of course, to a certain extent in James Lovelock's Gaia theory, which is shaped, it has a theological shape, even if it is allegedly a scientific theory.
Could I ask one very general question, which was that you told us about the ancient and medieval reflections on contingency, necessity, being, and so on. But you identified a general objection to this sort of argument, namely Kant's objection. This involves the application of concepts fashioned within the context of empirical experience.
Mm.
outside, necessarily beyond what could be an object of empirical experience. And that you mentioned the antinomies, but even if you don't think these give rise to antinomies, it's often been claimed that we simply cannot deploy those concepts in the way in which the metaphysician, in this particular case, the theological metaphysician, seeks to do so. But you also said that you used not to think so well of those arguments, but that had come to be better of them. Perhaps I just missed it, but what's the answer to the
to
the idea that you can't apply these concepts outside the context of formation?
Well, okay, Kant was worried about the concepts of his cause, substance, quality, and so on. But if you look at it, Avicenna doesn't use any of those concepts. His only concepts are those of truth and falsehood, is and not, is and isn't, and the idea of possibility, something, you know, the contingent being is something that might or might not exist. Non-existence is possible. Impossible being, well, we know that we can interdefine all the modal concepts of just given possibility and not. So he only uses concepts of logic. So I'm much more persuaded that Kant's argument doesn't really apply to this kind of way of presenting it. The more, if you can make it abstract enough, so you're assuming nothing more than those concepts that are contained within thinking as such, rather than the concepts that we use to organize our experience as an object of knowledge, then I think you escape from Kant's objection. But this is fairly technical, and I'm not 100% sure that is so, but I've never been 100% sure that Kant succeeds in making his objection stick either.
But interestingly, that response then is to say that we respect the condition that Kant imposed upon any such argument, which is that the concepts be used univocally, but avoid the difficulty by restricting the range of concepts to those which we think with confidence can be used univocally, because they're preconditions of the possibility of rational thought at all, truth, non-contradiction, and so on. But, as I'm sure you're well aware, there's another response to Kant, which is to say that these concepts, as indeed all concepts, have to be understood analogically in their application. And that once we see that, we see the possibility of it, which has to be made good, the possibility of finding conditions that enable us to extend the use of these concepts in ways that are not metaphorical, by the way, but are analogical.
Yes. This is getting very medieval. I've never swallowed the Thomist concept of analogy, I'm afraid.
Well, that's the end of that.
But then you just put a bit of imagery. The Lord is my shepherd. The Lord's a shepherd. So to address God as Father. This would be a Father. Is it imagery used all over the place?
Yes.
Which clearly would not be meant to take literally. And even Kant would say,
yes. Well, the Kant, what you're referring to as imagery, is not the same thing as what Aquinas means by analogy. But I entirely agree that if we are to refer to God at all, we have to dress him in the clothes of the ordinary human person. The Christian believes that he actually did this for us, and that's a very radical belief. But, of course, as I say, I'm not a theologian, but there is this tradition in both Christian and Islamic and Judaic thought that God can only be described apophatically, let's say by saying what he is not, and that all these images are there to help us on the way to discarding them. You know, and Maimonides goes on about this all the time. You know, that we can only know God by applying a predicate to him, and then seeing that, of course, such a predicate merely limits his nature and therefore cannot apply. Even being, for Maimonides, is something we can't say of God. We can understand the not being of God,
but not the being of God. You know, and if you go along this route, madness lies at the end.
And you might say that is the madness of medieval theology generally, the reason why it's all so unreadable now. But I wouldn't say that, but I would like to say something in later lectures about the function of those images, because they are, of course, giving God a face. And although it isn't literally true that the Lord is my shepherd, in another sense it is true. And that's what we find out by constructing the personal relation with God in the way that the imagery is suggesting. Yes, so.
You spoke about the persecution of heretics that is being removed by a small degree, and you also said that can happen within the scientific community. What specific example would you give of a scientific?
I didn't mean a genuinely scientific community, but some people can pretend to be guided by a science and still persecute the heretics within it. Obviously, international Marxism was a very good example of this. People constantly being persecuted as deviationists, infantilists, Trotskyists, or something. You know, somebody who disagreed that it was determination in the last instance. It was determination in the first instance which creates which moves the superstructure in obedience to the base. If you get that wrong, you end up shot. There was a certain time when you ended up shot, anyway. One would naturally say, well, that just shows that this isn't being taken as a science, but as a criterion of orthodox membership of the community.
The reason why I ask is that sort of the popular imagination, it's easier for people to think of witch hunts and religious communities. And why that? How can you say that behaviour applies to just generally human nature rather than just a specific example of why?
Yeah. Well, you're right that it could be deeper than science and deeper than religion, the desire for the witch hunt, the need for the witch hunt. This is something that René Girard talks about in his book on violence and the sacred. He thinks that there is a need in all human communities, under the pressure from the aggressive competition which is natural to us, which was mimetic desire, there's a need for a collective identification of a victim, to single someone out as the one who's the enemy within, and persecute him and do him to death. That way we all unite again. You know, so that it may be that witch hunting has a much deeper origin in the idea of the human community as such. But that religion is, as it were, built. Girard makes the further interesting suggestion that religion is built upon this, and our way of containing it. And then finally, he even gives a kind of proof of Christianity in his view that Christianity builds even further on it and doesn't merely contain it, but neutralizes it through the doctrine of forgiveness. But that's a very complicated way round that. This issue.
In East Buddhism, seems to suggest that both the concept of God and the concept of I are mistakes. That they are simply introducing duality into the oneness.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Well, in the sense, I have to say I don't agree with it. I often think that Buddhism is in sort of contradiction with itself on this issue, because its way of explaining the oneness of things is always in terms of the unity that we experience in ourselves, that we can achieve within ourselves a sense of perfect, unfractured unity. Then, of course, we have to discard that too in order to achieve nirvana. But I would say that in a
that the old Hindu idea of the self of the world as being the true origin of its unity, the idea of Brahman, it is there in Buddhism too. But this is I'm not a scholar of Buddhism, and it may be that I would be forced in the end to disagree with Buddhism absolutely, rather than say that it's just saying what I'm saying in a slightly different language. But I will in later lectures talk not about Buddhism but about the Hindu version of the arguments for the oneness of God.
The idea that communion is the real presence of God, or experiencing God through community, does it have to be a religious community, or could it just be any other type?
Well, that's a very important point. One thing that there are two aspects to a religious community. One is that people identify themselves through their shared religion, and there are various customs that go along with it, like marriage customs, very obviously. But then there are the moments of ceremonial enactment of their unity. That seems to be part of every religion too. Things like the Christian communion, which is a ritualized presentation of the community at the altar. You could have one of these without the other. Protestantism tends towards the idea that the community is simply a community of those who accept my principles and my way of doing things. And there's no need for the ritualized endorsement of the community. Whereas Catholicism is perhaps at the other extreme. But both of these seem to be natural parts of any religion that we know, at least. And I would say that Durkheim is right in identifying these communal experiences as fundamental to what's going on. He calls them moments of social effervescence. A rather brilliant phrase. And he has in mind things like not just the taking communion at the altar and that sort of thing, but marriage ceremonies, birth ceremonies, bar mitzvah and so on. And I'll talk more about it as I go along. There's another gentleman here, yes.
He answered it.
Right, okay.
Any others? Observations? Questions? We draw attention at the bottom line here to three metaphysical words. I'm going to be saying that another word needs to be added to this, which is essentially the we.
Yes. And that was obviously what was referred to by the last question. But I thought three is enough to be going on. We'll talk about these three next time, but gradually, of course, moving towards the need that lies deep within us all for a first person plural. Whether that need is something which is pointing in the direction of the transcendental is a very important question.
Well, I'm about to provide for a different need, which is for a glass of wine. But can I just, first of all, before I thank you for the lecture, draw to people's attention to the fact that tomorrow evening, there is to be a further performance of Sweden's opera, The Minister. There was a performance of this a few weeks ago, but as part of the On the Rocks Festival? On the Rocks Student Arts Festival, in the Bayer Theatre tomorrow evening at 10:15, there will be a performance of the opera The Minister, preceded, I think, by some introductory remarks. But prior even to that, at 8 o'clock, I think it is tomorrow, in Parliament Hall across in South Street, there's a debate or a large discussion around the themes of beauty and the role of beauty in the arts, the human experience and the contribution that these make to human well-being, particularly through social expression and so on. And that's something else that you'll be taking part in. I don't know, do you know whether there's going to be a re-showing of the film?
There might be, yes. I think there is.
There was a film which some of you will have seen that's written and made for BBC a few months ago. And I think there may be a re-screening of that as well. So for those of you who are interested in art, beauty and their roles in society, between this occasion and the next of the lectures, which is on Thursday in here at 5:15, there's that further opportunity. More immediately, you have an opportunity for further discussion across in Royal College Hall, eased and oiled by wine. But for now, could we just begin a practice that we're going to have reason to repeat for the next few weeks? That is, thank you, Roger Scruton, very much.